find your sitting posture, you know, whether you're on a bench or a chair or a cushion. As we know, it doesn't much matter. We just want to try to make sure that we're feeling kind of centered and relaxed, that we're sitting in a way that's, you know, sort of a kindness to the body, and yet that allows us to remain awake and alert and focused. And so, yeah, sitting up straight, you know, with our shoulders back and head up, and, arms at our sides, and hands maybe relaxed in our laps or folded in our laps or relaxed on the legs. Then allowing our eyes to gently close and the attention to come to rest on the breathing. Whether we note that mostly as the air moving in and out of the nostrils, maybe as the rising and falling of the abdomen, maybe as the gentle rhythmic contraction and expansion of the entire body. The Buddha didn't teach watching the breath. He taught being mindful of breathing, feeling the breathing process going on within us and around us, feeling the aliveness that is signified by respiration. And allowing the focus on the breathing to begin to calm the mind. That's whatever little particles may have been suspended in the water of the clear forest pool of the mind gradually sink to the bottom, so it becomes possible to see through and see all that is there. And within this field of calm awareness, being able to note not only the breathing itself, but also bodily sensations and sounds and thoughts, whether of the past or the present or the future, and emotions. Each of these phenomena in the mind, watching them carefully as they arise and change and pass away, allowing whatever is the mind's predominant object of attention to likewise become the object of meditation. Observe these phenomena floating by like bubbles in a stream. So ultimately, the object of meditation is the ceaseless flow of experience itself. So let's take a stretch break for a few moments, and I'll ring the bell again. We can get back together, have some announcements, and we'll talk. Just to continue to expand and scope the longer I work on it. Yesterday, I probably worked later into the day, into the heat and the smoke than was wise. Last night, my heart went into atrial fibrillation, and it can be either brought on or aggravated by intense particulate air pollution. So I think that's probably what happened. So I'm still in AFib now. I've been spent part of the day in bed. So I think I'm going to keep it a little shorter than usual tonight. And it probably end earlier than we usually do, but I did want to offer a few thoughts having to do with the Buddha's teaching in this situation. And the teaching I wanted to spend a little time reflecting on and maybe us discussing a little is two related concepts that the Buddha taught. And those two are the Pali words are Samvega and Pasada. Samvega is translated sometimes as worry or anxiety. And pasada it means confidence. And in the teachings on Samvega, there are certain objects of anxiety or worry, or if the emotion is strong, fear, that classically arise in the mind. And one of those is fear of physical harm, injury or infirmity, fear of dying, fear of death, fear of what in the texts is called loss of sustenance. And this means, in the physical sense, it means not having enough to eat. It means starving, fear of starvation, which was, you know, not all that uncommon in the Buddha's time for people who were really poor. And then there are a couple of interesting other ones that are in there that are more karmic related. One is fear of the future consequences of past unskillful behavior. Okay, the karmic payback, right? And another is fear of the consequences of future unskillful behavior. You might do something in the future and, you know, cause problems for yourself and others. Okay. The one thing that all those, these forms of objects of worry, anxiety, fear hold in common is that the emotions that they arouse, because the things, these objects of fear, anxiety, or worry are just facts, you know, they're aspects of the human condition. So the worry or the anxiety or the fear is aroused by virtue of a sense of self. Who is afraid? Who is anxious? Who is worried? It's the self. And, you know, it's pretty universal stuff. It's, you know, and the fact that we find ourselves anxious or worried or afraid of any of these things is not mean that we're bad yogis or anything. It's just, it's the human condition. It's the nature of mind, right? And so what the Buddha taught was, and the Samvega in the Buddha's teachings is not a bad thing, actually. The Buddha said it's like fuel for it, one's quest for the Dharma. Okay. That it is an impetus to inquire, well, why am I afraid? Why am I anxious? What's going on here? What's the nature of the mind that cannot accept these things that are difficult to bear, these forms of dukkha? And so the Buddha said it's really worth getting to know these states of mind when they occur and appreciate them for what they are and where they're coming from, because they can have the effect of providing motivation to investigate the Dharma. And then when it becomes possible through sitting and studying and whatnot to see the relationship between the worry, the anxiety, the fear, and the sense of self, that at some point when it really kind of starts to sink in that, right, one causes the other, you know, that on occasion when the sense of self is not strong, or sometimes when it's even absent altogether, then there is the sense of freedom, of buoyancy, right? I mean, that's pasada, the Buddha says, when we get this glimpse, aha, it's all about the self. And if I can hold the mind's activity in creating self with kind regard instead of aversion, right? Then that's where the freedom lies, or that's where the possibility of freedom begins to become evident. And so that, so the impetus to stay on the path and really, you know, dive deep, this becomes strong. And it's fostered by, it's fueled by, it's energized by, it's activated by the Samvega. Know, the aspects of something. So these teachings are relevant to me today, and why I decided to speak about them for a few minutes, because I know them well, you know, I know the territory well. You know, I tend to be kind of an aversive type, and I, you know, on occasion been clinically treated for a combination of depression and anxiety, generalized anxiety disorder, I think is the label in the DSM. So I know about that, right? And I've spent a lot of my lifetime, number one, experiencing those states and then understanding simultaneously the truth of the Buddha's teaching about not self. And so when the mind is expansive and open, then it's possible just to sit back and watch, you know, watch the anxieties arise when they do and what the object of the anxiety is. And so it's possible to kind of contextualize it or see it a little more clearly. That's the shtick. The reality. The reality is that when one of these AFib episodes hits, you know, and it lasts, you know, pretty, you know, and it stretches out over, you know, a couple of days or so, then the anxiety just arises, you know, and sense of, oh, wow, really? You know, again? And it's just there, you know, I watch the, you know, I actually have mixed views about this Apple Watch because it's such a good cardiac monitor. I have this tendency to keep going, you know, poking at it and say, well, am I over it? Am I over it? not so helpful, actually. So I've got to start rationing myself. But so, like, even after all these years and you know, and studying these concepts and knowledge of them, when the physical condition arises, the anxiety does too. It's just there. It's just part of it, you know. And so it's become, for me, as part of my practice, it's become kind of important to simply have patience with it, you know, that because there are aspects of it, you know, like there's a, sometimes I feel kind of queasy or unsteady, really, really, really low energy. And just this in body's internal sense or knowing that something's not quite right, you know, that something's a little off. And down the road, there are treatments that I could, you know, I can have a harder look at. I just am not interested in having them fool around with the heart till, you know, if they don't have to. So it's just, you know, the kind of the way things are right now. And right now, the work for me, I think for all of us, is more than anything else, it's just acceptance. It's just, this is how it is now. This is how it is now. And both things are true. I understand that the anxiety comes from selfing, and that selfing is something the mind is doing. And inasmuch as I am not a fully enlightened being, selfing happens. It just comes with the territory. And so learning to come into a genuine state of acceptance of the occasional feelings of anxiety that arise, or you know, a little bit of depression or sadness, or you know, just the blues associated with having things be a little off, that's really kind of the working edge for me. You know, it's not so much the physical stuff itself, which is more just kind of an annoyance than anything else. It doesn't lead to sudden cardiac death by and large, but it can lead to a stroke if you don't keep up with your meds. The other thing that's going on, and this is really helpful for me in terms of keeping things in perspective, is that my wife has a friend from her college days who lives in rural Colorado. And a few years ago, she developed multiple myeloma and underwent a pretty intensive and grueling treatment regimen, including a lot of chemotherapy. And she went into remission. And she was asymptomatic for several years. And then quite recently, she developed leukemia, and the form of leukemia that she has is one that is commonly associated as a side effect of chemo, right? So in all likelihood, it was the chemo she took for the myeloma that's causing the leukemia that she has now. And it's pretty well along. She's getting whole blood transfusions now to keep her alive, and at the same time there's targeted chemo that they're using again to try to kill off the cells in the marrow. But it's, you know, it's a pretty intense situation. Her treatments are happening at a medical center here in Denver, and since she lives in a rural area, we've offered her to stay with us because she comes down once a month. She comes to Denver for a week to undergo her treatments. And so she's staying with us when she comes to Denver, starting this week, actually. And she stayed with us several times in the past. And she is former practicing registered nurse, doesn't have a Dharma practice or any, you know, other spiritual practice that I'm aware of, but there is a real calmness, a real calmness about her, kind of a matter of factness. And some days the treatments hit her really hard, and you know, she comes back here to our home and just, you know, just has to lie down and let her body deal with what's being done to it. But there is this, just this calmness, just, you know, day to day, moment to moment, this is how it is now. That for me is, it's kind of inspiring and reassuring, you know, because my little AFib is like chump change, you know, relative to what she's going through. And it's, we don't talk about it, she and I don't talk about it, you know, haven't talked about it in any real detail, but there is this kind of shift a little bit that I'm experiencing in my own thinking, and it has to do with the whole concept of death, you know, like death as a thing, as a noun, you know, in our culture, and historically, we personify it, you know, usually as some skeleton in a black hooded robe with a scythe or something along those lines, you know, an entity to be feared, you know, making a thing of it, you know, and so who or what does that? Well, duh, it's the self, you know, that takes the concept of not being around very personally, finds it profoundly insulting, in fact, right? And so that the self sets up this adversary relationship with not wanting, you know, like Jack Kornfield says, the problem with the self is that it wants to be present for its own funeral, you know, which is what makes the, it's one of the cosmic practical jokes of the Dharma, of course, you know, it creates in the self the desire to be free itself. So one of the things that I've noticed every now and then, a little kind of flash, is that when the self disappears, death disappears. Because it's the self that creates the thing, right? So there is, you know, I don't anymore, I don't tend to talk about death as a thing so much, you know, I think that there's the fear of the unknown that comes with contemplating death. There's the fear of the dying process itself, you know, and that's the whole Tibetan book of the Great Liberation on Hearing in the Bardo is about that. It's about the spiritual friend being with the person who is dying in a kind and comforting way so that they don't die in fear, so they don't lose their life in fear. One of the great Tibetan Rinpoches, who is dying in an intensive care ward in a medical center in Illinois, I think it was, his senior students and followers were gathered around him, and they were, you know, concerned, grieving. He said, "Don't worry, nothing happens. There's life, and then there's not life. It's pretty much as simple as that. Very straightforward, you know." And so there is, and my wife's friend, you know, there's almost this ease about her that I'm finding, you know, I appreciate, because I think I would have sort of expected it maybe more if she was a really kind of realized Dharma student or something like that. But she's just a person in the world, just a mansion, or just one of us, right? And so find it kind of comforting to know that that capacity for being with situations as grave or challenging as these exists. It exists within us, you know. And it really invites us to draw a little closer to the things that scare us, you know, to investigate them with a little more care. And, you know, and a little humility, you know, I find this, it's always humbling for me when these events happen, just kind of a reminder, you know, it pierces the veil of illusion that nothing bad's ever going to happen. Right? Stuff happens. But if we can be with it, you know, with care and with kindness, it doesn't have to be a bummer. It is, it's just what it is. You know, Sharon Salzberg told me one time that I was facing a health challenge, and she told me the story about when she got some test came back that indicated that she might possibly have uterine cancer, and which is a fairly serious one, and that it wasn't going to be possible for them to know whether she did or not without doing exploratory surgery to kind of confirm one way or the other. And so she told me that in the days leading up to the surgery, I did a lot of sitting, and of course, you know, she was a kind of a master of the teaching of the practice of metta, and so she was doing a lot of metta practice for herself and opening the field of awareness. And, she said it was really an interesting experience because she could really, you know, through all this training, all this experience, what she could really relax into and open up into this really vast metta field where everything was okay and everything was as it was, and there was just, she felt this sort of love for herself flowing out in all directions. And she could feel the love of others who cared about her flowing into her, towards her as well. And she could just kind of reside in that space for a while. And then she said, all of a sudden, the whole thing would collapse. And it was down to like the size of a baseball or something. And she was just like this teeny little fetus that wanted to, you know, scurry under a rock someplace, you know, and just the mind is just overtaken with terror, you know, though, holy shit, you know, I might be getting ready to check out here. And then after a while, it would come back again. And so the reason I appreciated her telling me this story was in some correspondence between the two of us. Is that we tend to reify or project onto these teachers who are knowledge masters of what they're teaching, you know, and embody it, live it, you know, that somehow or another they are beyond the kinds of feelings and emotions and whatnot that that we mortals succumb to on occasion. That doesn't work like that. So you need to be ready for the mind to do anything without expectations of yourself, right? Just show up, just be there with as kind and open a heart as possible when that's possible, And then when everything collapses, then that's what's going on, right? It's, I don't, for those of you who may have been with people who are dying, even people who are of really calm demeanor and have really made peace with the fact that life is leaving them, right? The end is near. Nonetheless, you know, once consciousness has evidently left the body, in those last few moments, you know, the body goes down swinging. It just really doesn't want to die. You know, there's a struggle for the last few breaths usually, you know, even if the person was in a calm, peaceful state of mind at the time they lost consciousness, there's still that aspect of the body that wants to keep living, and it's going to keep doing what it can to stay alive until it can. So some things remain beyond our control, you know, and those are to be acknowledged and respected. And then there are other times when it's possible to be there in the absolute fullness of the moment, and be ready for whatever's going to happen. So anyway, not so brief but spectacular take on Samvega and Pasala. Questions or comments, thoughts anyone might want to share about anything that I've said? Going once, going twice. Jason.
Tara Lloyd. Hey, long time no see. Appreciated the talk and well-timed, but turning on my mic to chime in just with a note of compassion. Seems like you've wrapped your mind and your heart around AFib well enough, but that's hard, and wanted to let you know I'm feeling compassion from over here for you.
Thank you. I really appreciate your kind words. Good. Phoebe, I saw your hand go up.
Yes, I just think it's remarkable that you're able to give a calm talk in the midst of the AFib experience. Thank you.
I appreciate your words. It's, you know, it is what it is. It's, I've been dealing with it for close to 20 years now. So you can make your peace with it or not, but I've found that it's, life's better if I do. Okay.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to hear more about why you think that the AFib is small potatoes compared to what the nurse had, because cancer can be an ideal way to go for some people. AFib, like whammo. Well, I'm not going to tell you what it's like.
Well, you know, there is what the normal course is for people that have the condition. Now, it's seldom, like I said, seldom results in sudden cardiac death. The more normal course is that gradually, as one ages, the events become a little more frequent, and they last for a longer period of time. And so there's one med that I take that when the heart rate gets up around 130, 147, that slows it back down again. So you want to get it down below about 130 or so. So it's being very rapidly, but not very effectively. So it's not moving the blood around too well. And I'm taking a blood thinner to prevent a stroke from occurring. And then gradually the thing just kind of slows down. As the situation progresses, there's another med that you can take that doesn't, it's not about rate, it's about regularizing the rhythm. And I tried that for a while, but I had absolutely every side effect in the book. And so I just really couldn't tolerate it. And then there's a surgical procedure down the road called ablation. And sort of the common thing now, it used to be done with a cautery tool, and now it's they freeze the little nerves up there that are misfiring instead. So works about 3/4 of the time. Not that risky a procedure. It's a pretty common one. And so that might be in my future. But my cardiologist also said, well, you know, if you were to lose 15 pounds, exercise a little bit more regularly, and stop drinking alcohol, that would probably be just about as effective as any of the meds that I'm giving it. So I'm actually in recovery for alcohol abuse now. And so my episodes have actually not been so frequent. Working on the diet and exercise part. And so I'm hoping that if I really discipline myself, I can either dial back the episodes or at least, you know, put it off a little longer until I may decide to have one of these procedures done. But it's seldom a fatal condition. But it is a progressive condition. And it's just, and it's a constant reminder. You know, when I'm doing four elements practice, for instance, and the earth element, the solidity, the water element, the fluidity, the air element, the breathing, the fire element, the object that I take for focusing in the body, focusing on the fire element, is my pulse. And because it's something that if you don't have, you know, something like an arrhythmia, it's something you take for granted, right? You don't think about it. But when I'm doing four elements practice and I'm using my pulse as the object of meditation for the fire element, and I do it, if you interlace your fingers like this, you can feel your pulse between your fingers, you know. There's, in addition to noting the object, there's always just this little element of gratitude as well. It's like, oh, here she is, you know, chugging along, doing the job, you know. So there is, when things are going well, there is an appreciation of the functioning of the body that I didn't used to have before. I don't know if I would necessarily say I'm grateful for the condition, but I've learned a lot from it. And it really does sort of keep me mindful. Right? Okay. But, yeah. Kathleen, please.
You know, I was thinking when you were giving Sharon's example that sometimes when I'm afraid, I can be in a adult mode afraid, or which then you can easily, or not easily, but eventually say it's okay to die. It's as you said, it's not that big of a deal, you know, it might hurt a little bit, but you know, it might hurt a lot, but it's okay to die. But sometimes the fear states are from childhood, where you had a lot fewer resources to know what was going on, and so it's I haven't quite figured out how to transfer to the adult state fear. Sometimes I do, but sometimes not. There's the sheer terror of childhood that just didn't have the wide perspective that we have now.
Yeah. Yes. Tara Brach, you know, the Dharma teacher and the psychotherapist, says, you know, it's kind of the psychological aspects of Dharma practice She said, she calls it reparenting. And she says, you know, it's learning how to be unto yourself the parent you wish you'd had. Instead of the ones you got. So Jack Kornfield does this a fair amount too, that when there is that just that terror, that, you know, mindless fear or whatever, when it arises, that it's helpful. And for those of us who may have experienced significant childhood trauma in particular, if it's possible to personify the fear as a small child that you can take in your arms, hold in your lap, okay, and be with and comfort, okay, because that fear oftentimes is quite primal, comes from a very early place, you know, it's not rational, but it's a powerful emotion, right? And I was talking with Jack once about this, Jack Kornfield. And so, there's this tendency at first when you feel overpowered by the emotion, that it feels like some kind of big hairy monster that's getting ready to devour you or something. And then he said, when you can see it with the eyes of compassion, it shrinks down to be a frightened child. You know, the two are not different. Yeah, it's how you regard the emotion that you're feeling that matters. And that when you're able to affect that transition from one to the other to an entity within you that you can care for and feel compassion for, then it has the effect of starving the fear of fuel, you know, of just, you know, recognizing it for what it is, appreciating it for what it is. That, you know, fear has a purpose, just like physical pain has a purpose, you know, and it's survival based. So if your fear, if there's a terror that arises that may have some association to childhood trauma or something like that, you know, that the frightened child remembered the situation clearly in an effort to try to make sure that she or he never finds themselves in that place again. Okay, and so when the fear arises, it's trying to avoid having that same thing happen again. And so it becomes possible to look and, you know, instead of the fear all around, the fear saturating, if you can look inside and say, who is really feeling this? Who is really feeling this? Okay. Then it becomes something kind of tender and manageable, and something that you can regard kindly and calmly, as a parent would a frightened child. And it's easier or more possible sometimes than other times. Just like, you know, what Sharon was talking about. Sometimes we have the capacity to do that, other times not so much. And when we don't, we simply need to acknowledge that as well. Okay. Well, Luke, let's call this one Samvega and Pasada, Samvega. And Pasada, Pasada.
Thank you, Tara Lloyd. Will do.
Yeah. Okay, good. Okay, well, let's settle in and find our sitting posture again just for a moment if we can. Allow the eyes to gently close. Attention to come to rest on the breathing. Bhavatu sava mangalam rakantu sava devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava buddha nubhavena sada soti bhavantute. By the power of all the Buddhas, may you always be well. Vavati sava mangalam rakanti sava devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava dhamma nubhavena sala sote bhavantute. By the power of all the dharmas, may you always be well. Bhavatu sava mangalam rakantu sava devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava sangha ubhavena sada soti bhavantute. By the power of all the sanghas, may you always be well. Bhavati sava mangalam rakantu sava devata. May there be every blessing, and may all the devas protect you. Stay safe and be well, everybody. Kaya Kun Dharma.
Thank you, Tara Lloyd.
Thank you, Tara Lloyd.
Thanks, Tara Lloyd. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Tara Lloyd, very much.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Stay well.